You know that feeling when it's like 2 in the morning, the house is completely just suffocatingly quiet, and you've fallen down this massive internet rabbit
Oh
hole?
yeah, never a great place to be at 2 a.m.
Right. And I don't mean the fun kind of rabbit hole, you know, where you're looking up the history of wooden roller coasters or trying to figure out how they film those massive crowd scenes in movies.
Not the harmless trivia stuff.
Exactly. I mean, the heavy, slightly terrifying kind. Like, you're reading about neuroscience. You're staring at the glowing screen, looking at these complex diagrams of synapses, neurotransmitters, action potentials, all that
The
stuff.
really dense biological mechanics of it all.
Yeah. And suddenly, out of nowhere, this creeping sense of profound dread just washes over you. You look away from the screen, you look down at your own hands resting on the keyboard, and you start wondering, am I actually in control here?
That is a very specific, very real kind of panic.
It is, because if everything we think and everything we feel and every single thing we do is ultimately just a collection of firing neurons, right? Chemical reactions and electrical impulses cascading like dominoes in the dark space of our skulls.
Just physics and chemistry playing out.
Right, just physics. If that's true, are we really making choices? Or are we, and this is the thought that keeps you awake staring at the ceiling, are we just biological puppets?
It's a deeply unsettling place to find yourself, and I think it's worth pausing to acknowledge just how incredibly common that specific type of panic is.
It's super common, right? I mean, I've definitely felt it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're describing a very modern, very specific kind of dread. This isn't the ancient fear of the unknown, like being afraid of what's lurking in the dark woods.
Right, it's almost the opposite.
Exactly. It's actually a fear of the known. It's the creeping sensation that science, in its relentless march to understand how things work, is slowly explaining us away.
Explaining us away. Wow, yeah, that
Yeah.
perfectly captures it.
It feels like every new neuroimaging study or biological discovery is reducing the human experience. You know, our loves, our fears, our agonizing life choices into mere gears in a wet, squishy, predetermined machine.
That is exactly the feeling. It's this underlying anxiety that the more we know about the physical mechanics of the brain, the less we actually
Like
exist.
you're being deleted by the data.
Yes. It feels like the concept of me is just a user interface hiding a bunch of cold, calculating code.
Right.
And that anxiety is exactly the mission of our deep dive
I'm
today.
very excited for this one.
Me too. We are taking a microscope to a brilliant, dense, and frankly liberating piece of philosophical and scientific writing. It's called The Architect of Agency: Beyond Neuroexistentialist Anxiety.
It's a fantastic text.
Ugh.
Really dense, but so rewarding.
Yeah, so our goal today is to unpack this single powerful source, because here's the promise this text makes. If we look closely at what it's arguing, if we really understand the mechanics of what it's proposing, we can undergo a shift in perspective.
A pretty massive shift, too.
Huge. A shift that completely dissolves that 2 a.m. existential dread. We can get our free will back, basically, without having to ignore or dilute the hard science.
Which, I mean, that is an incredibly ambitious promise. To understand how the text pulls that off, we need to clearly outline the core conflict it presents.
Let's do it. Set the stage for us.
Okay, so the author essentially sets up a battle between two fundamentally different frameworks for viewing the brain and human behavior. On one side of the ring, you have what the text calls a reductive eliminativist view.
Eliminativist. Okay.
Right, that's the domino-falling biological puppet view you just described. It's the framework that methodically strips away meaning, intention, and free will, leaving you with nothing but that cold dread.
The dread-inducing framework, I think I'm unfortunately very familiar with that one.
Most of us are, even if we don't know the academic terms for it. And on the other side of the ring, the text presents a powerful alternative, an embodied and active or predictive processing framework.
Embodied predictive processing? That sounds a lot more active.
It is. This is the view that he also argues restores meaning. It grounds agency in biological reality rather than treating it as a magical illusion.
Grounding it in reality, I like that.
Yeah, so what we are going to do today is explore how moving from the first view to the second view doesn't just tweak your understanding of some obscure neuroscience concepts, it fundamentally rewrites how you view your own sense of self.
It changes everything.
Exactly.
Huh.
It changes the nature of every single everyday choice you make.
Okay, I am so ready for this rewrite. But to appreciate the solution, I think we have to start by really understanding the trap.
The trap is deep.
It really is. In the text, they call this out as the traditional neuroexistentialist assumption. And the core of this assumption relies on looking at the brain as a, and this is a quote, passive causal chain of neural events.
A passive causal chain.
Right. When I read that phrase, it felt like a very bleak mathematical equation, like brain equals passive causal chain, therefore free will is a hallucination.
And therefore your decisions are strictly determined by prior physical causes.
Exactly. Causes that stretch all the way back to the dawn of time.
It is a bleak equation, but you have to admit, it possesses a certain kind of flawless, terrifying logic.
It really does. It's hard to argue with at first glance.
To really grasp what the text is dismantling, we have to break down what it actually means to take a reductive, eliminativist reading of science.
Mm-hmm.
Those are heavy academic words, but they're absolutely crucial here.
Right. Let's unpack those. What does reductive actually mean in this context?
When a scientist or a philosopher is being reductive, they're operating on the premise that a complex system is fundamentally nothing but the sum of its simplest, smallest parts.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. So if I'm being reductive about a cake.
Okay, a cake, go on.
I'm saying the cake doesn't really exist, right? It's just an arrangement of flour, eggs, sugar, and heat. The cakiness is just a shorthand we use, but the reality is just the molecules of the ingredients.
You're in the right neighborhood, absolutely.
Yeah.
But let's push that even further. The eliminativist part of that phrase is where the real damage happens.
Okay, so how does eliminativist go further than just reductive?
Eliminative materialism argues that once you fully understand those base parts, the molecules, the chemistry, the physics, the higher level concepts you use to describe the system can literally be eliminated from our vocabulary.
Eliminated entirely.
Entirely. They aren't just shorthand. They are considered false concepts. They're outdated, primitive fictions we used before we understood the underlying machinery.
Wait, so applied to the brain.
Applied to the brain. And eliminativist looks at things like belief, desire, love, and choice, and says, these don't actually exist.
Wow, that is aggressive.
It is. They argue that a reductive, eliminativist reading of neuroscience requires us to look at the brain purely from the outside. Imagine you are a scientist looking at a highly advanced, real-time brain scan.
Okay, I'm picturing the glowing monitor.
You see an electrical impulse start in one cluster of neurons. You watch it travel along a nerve fiber, cross a synapse, and trigger a chemical release in another area. Cause-effect. Cause-effect.
Just one physical event causing another physical event.
Precisely. A purely passive chain.
Just a sequence of physical dominoes knocking into each other. Where is the room for me in that?
Exactly the problem. If you look at the brain from this specific isolated angle from the outside, as a purely passive observer tracking a chain reaction of physics and chemistry, it inevitably leads you to the conclusion that human agency has to be a biological illusion.
Because there's no break in the chain.
Right. Think about the chain of causality. If every thought you have was caused by a prior neural event, and that neural event was caused by a prior environmental stimulus.
And that stimulus was caused by the laws of physics operating on matter.
Yes, going all the way back in an unbroken chain to the Big Bang. Where does you stepping in and freely making a choice actually happen?
I mean, looking at it that way, nowhere.
The eliminativist looks at the math and says, nowhere. The you is an illusion generated by the dominoes.
I'm feeling that 2 a.m. panic creeping back in, because when you lay it out like that, it sounds airtight.
It sounds incredibly convincing.
But as I was reading this text, and specifically focusing on why the author calls this a reductive mistake, an analogy came to mind. I want to test this on you, because I think it highlights where this flawless logic actually completely derails.
Oh, I love a good analogy. Let's hear it.
Okay. Imagine you, the listener, are looking at a beautiful digital photograph on your computer screen. Maybe it's a picture of your family laughing, or like a stunning sunset over the ocean.
Something that evokes an emotion.
Right. When you look at it, it makes you feel something. It has meaning. It's a real image capturing a real moment. Now imagine a computer scientist walks up behind you, looks over your shoulder, and says, let's be reductive here. Let's look at the underlying reality of what you're staring at.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. They take your mouse and they zoom in on the image. They zoom past the faces, past the colors, past the individual pixels, all the way down into the machine code of the file.
Down to the binary.
Exactly. And they show you that the picture, fundamentally, is literally just a string of ones and zeros. Millions of binary digits interacting with the computer's hardware.
Which, to be fair to the computer scientist, is the factual underlying physical reality of the digital file. They aren't lying about the ones and zeros.
True. They aren't lying. It is made of binary code. But, and this is the big but, if that computer scientist then turned to you and said, therefore, the picture is an illusion, the sunset isn't real, the smiles on your family's faces aren't real, it's just ones and zeros, you would look at them like they had lost their minds.
You'd think they were completely missing the point.
Exactly. To say the picture is a hallucination just because it's made of code is a massive reductive mistake. When you argue against the computer scientists, you aren't denying the existence of the ones and zeros.
Right, you accept the code is there?
You are acknowledging that when those ones and zeros are organized in a specific, massively complex way, a completely new reality emerges. The picture is real. The higher level organization matters.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. What's crucial about your analogy is how perfectly it maps onto the text's central criticism of the neuroexistentialist trap.
It's the same error in thinking.
It really is. The author of this paper is not denying the neurons. They aren't denying the chemistry, the electrical impulses, or the physics of the brain. They're pointing out that we've been staring so closely at the microscopic binary code of the brain that we've mistakenly concluded the resulting image doesn't exist.
We're zooming in too far.
Yes. The realization that this is a flaw in our perspective, that reductionism misses the forest for the trees, leads naturally to the profound alternative proposed by the text. If looking at the brain as a passive chain of microscopic events is the wrong approach, how should we be looking at it?
And this brings us to what might be my favorite part of the entire source material,
banishing
the ghost.
Ah, yes. The ghost in the machine.
Because the text doesn't just say, hey, stop looking at the ones and zeros. It proposes an alternative framework that sounds almost rebellious against classical science. The text states that the embodied brain is an active, self-organizing system that generates agency.
It actively generates it.
It actively generates it. And the text makes a very specific historical note here. It says this framework explains how agency is real, but, quote, just not in the Cartesian ghost in the machine sense. So I feel like before we can understand the self-organizing part, we have to talk about this ghost.
We definitely do.
Who is this Cartesian ghost and why are we banishing it?
So to understand the ghost, we have to travel back to the 17th century and look at the philosopher René Descartes. He is the architect of what we call Cartesian dualism.
Okay, Descartes.
Right. And his thinking still massively infects how we view ourselves today, even if we don't realize it.
Mm.
Descartes was looking at the physical world, which science was increasingly revealing to be a complex mechanical system governed by strict physical laws.
Like clockwork.
Exactly. He looked at the human body and thought, well, the physical body is clearly just a machine. It's meat, bones, and fluids acting on those same physical laws.
Right. The body is just an organic clockwork mechanism.
Precisely. But Descartes had a problem. He knew intimately and undeniably from his own internal first-person experience that he had a mind. He experienced consciousness.
He experienced making choices.
Yes. This led to his famous declaration, I think, therefore, I am. So to reconcile the mechanical reality of the body with the conscious reality of the mind, he proposed a radical split.
Okay, what was the split?
He argued that human beings are made of two completely fundamentally different substances. There's the physical stuff, the machine, the body, and there's the non-physical immaterial stuff, the mind, the soul.
The ghost.
The ghost. He literally believed this immaterial ghost sat inside the pineal gland in the brain, pulling the levers and steering the physical machine.
So we are essentially spiritual pilots driving around in biological meat suits.
That's the exact image. And culturally, we clung to that idea for centuries. We loved it. We needed the ghost to be the thing that possessed free will, because a mechanical clockwork machine obviously can't have free will.
Right. Gears don't make choices.
Exactly. But then, as the centuries passed, neuroscience advanced. We got better tools. We opened up the machine to look for the pilot.
And I'm guessing we didn't find one.
We mapped the brain. We tracked the chemicals. We recorded the electricity. We looked everywhere inside the skull. And we couldn't find the ghost. We just found more machine, more wet, squishy, complicated biology.
Which triggered the existential panic.
Huge panic.
Because if there's no pilot steering the ship, no ghost pulling the levers, then it feels like it's just a runaway machine hurtling down the tracks.
You've hit the nail on the head. The neuroexistential dread happens because people accept the scientific reality that the ghost is gone. But, and this is the critical error, they keep Descartes' old, flawed definition of the machine.
Oh, wow. Wait, say that again.
They keep the old definition of the machine. they still view the physical biological body as this passive, dead, mechanical thing that only moves when it's pushed by prior causes.
Though we accepted half of the new science but kept the depressing half of the old philosophy.
Exactly. But this text argues for a monumental shift in how we define biology. We don't need an immaterial ghost to have real agency, because the biological machine isn't what Descartes thought it was.
It's not passive.
The brain is not a passive thing waiting to be triggered. It is an active, self-organizing system. It doesn't just passively react to the world like a billiard ball being struck. It actively constructs, predicts, and organizes itself to survive.
Okay, I have to jump in and push back here on behalf of anyone listening who is still feeling that 2 a.m. dread.
Please do.
Because I'm struggling with this leap. I hear what you're saying. We get rid of the magic ghost, and we accept that we are purely physical, biological systems that self-organize. But how does that actually save free will?
That's the million-dollar question.
Let me give you an example. Think about a robotic vacuum cleaner, like a Roomba. A Roomba is a physical system. It is an active system.
It certainly moves around a lot.
Right. It moves around my living room. It bumps into a wall. It adapts by turning around. It seeks out dirt. And when its battery gets low, it actively navigates back to its charging station to survive and maintain its order.
It self-organizes its behavior.
Exactly. It's a physical, active, self-organizing system without a ghost. But nobody in their right mind thinks a Roomba has free will or agency. It's just following complex algorithms written by an engineer.
Right.
So if I am just a biological self-organizing system, how am I not just a highly complicated, squishy Roomba? How is our biology not still just determinism wearing a fancier mask?
That is the perfect challenge to this framework, and it brings us to the very heart of the text argument. The difference between you and the robotic vacuum cleaner is profound, and it entirely revolves around the nature of goals.
Goals, okay.
Where those goals come from, and what is at stake? The text resolves this tension beautifully by defining agency, not as some mystical property, but as a biological capacity.
A biological capacity?
Yes. Look closely at the specific phrasing the author uses. They say, agency is a biological capacity. The organism does genuinely select among actions based on its own goals and values. And then they add this crucial part, which are real embodied states.
I want to highlight that phrase, real embodied states. What does that actually mean in contrast to the Roomba?
Let's look at the Roomba. Its goals, cleaning the floor, mapping the room, finding the charger, were imported from the outside.
They belong to the programmer.
Exactly. They were programmed into its silicon chips by a human engineer. The Roomba itself does not intrinsically care if it dies or runs out of battery. It doesn't care if the floor is dirty. It has no internal biological stake in its own existence.
It's merely executing a script.
It is. But you, as a living biological organism, are fundamentally different. You weren't assembled in a factory with preloaded software. You evolved from the ground up over billions of years through a relentless process of self-creation and survival.
Self-creation?
The scientific term for this is autopoiesis, a system capable of reproducing and maintaining itself. Your goals aren't imported from an engineer. They are intrinsically generated by the literal physical requirements of your biology.
So you're saying my need for water, my need for food, my drive for safety, these aren't just algorithms.
Not at all.
They are the physical prerequisites for me continuing to exist as a coherent physical object.
Exactly. They are real physical embodied states. If you don't drink water, your cells literally degrade, your internal order collapses, and you die. The stakes are absolute.
The Roomba doesn't degrade, it just powers down.
Right. When you select an action based on those deeply embedded life or death biological values, you are exercising real agency. You are doing the selecting.
Because I have skin in the game.
Literally. The system isn't being pushed blindly from the outside by environmental dominoes. It is actively pulling itself forward from the inside based on what it physically needs to maintain its own existence.
This is a major click for me. So the Roomba's goals are fake, essentially. They belong to the programmer. The machine is just a proxy.
Yes, exactly.
But my goals are real because my biology literally requires them to stave off death. I am the locus of the goal.
That's it. The organism itself is the locus of control. It's not an illusion just because it's made of biological material. The biological material and its desperate need to stay organized is the very thing that makes the agency real.
Okay, that feels like a massive pivot. If agency is a real, undeniable biological capacity based on our own internal survival goals, then we naturally have to ask who or what is actually holding those goals.
What is doing the steering?
Exactly. What is doing the steering? This brings us to a part of the text that really blew my mind, because it takes on the two biggest casualties of neuroexistentialism, the concept of the self and the concept of meaning.
Oh, yeah. Those usually get entirely wiped out.
Right. In that bleak 2 a.m. domino view of the brain, both of those concepts are usually destroyed.
They're entirely collateral damage in the reductive view. Let's look closely at a table the author provides in the source material, which contrasts the two frameworks side by side.
Okay, what does the table say?
Under the traditional neuroexistentialist column, it states starkly, the self is a fiction.
Ouch.
And right below that, meaning is projected onto a valueless physical world.
I mean, that tracks with the eliminativist logic we talked about earlier. If everything is just atoms bumping into atoms governed by the laws of physics, then the feeling of you is just a hallucination generated by the atoms.
A completely passive hallucination.
And the universe itself doesn't care about anything. It's just cold, dead matter. So any meaning we feel is just a fairy tale we invent to feel better.
But look at the alternative the text provides in the next column. It contrasts the idea that the self is a fiction with the bold assertion that the self is a dynamic predictive model.
A dynamic predictive model.
Yes. And it contrasts the depressing idea that meaning is projected with the concept that meaning is enacted.
Enacted, okay.
Let's spend some time pulling apart this concept of the self as a functional adaptive reality. In the embodied framework we're exploring, the brain's primary overriding job is to keep the delicate biological body alive in a highly complex, constantly changing, and often dangerous environment.
Right. Basic survival.
Now, to do that efficiently, the brain cannot simply wait for things to happen and then passively react.
Why not? Why can't it just be an input-output machine? You touch a hot stove, you pull your hand away. Input-output.
Because relying solely on reaction is a terrible survival strategy. If you wait until the predator has already bitten you to react,
it's too late.
Or if you wait until you are completely starving to begin looking for food, you're too late. The processing time required for sensory information to travel from your skin up your spinal cord into your brain, be processed, and send a motor command back down to your muscles.
It takes too long.
It's incredibly slow in biological terms. A purely reactive organism gets eaten. To survive, the brain has to be one step ahead. It has to predict what is going to happen next.
It has to anticipate the future.
Yes. It has to constantly generate hypotheses about the state of the world and the state of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And to effectively predict how the complex outside environment will impact the body, the brain has to build a model.
A model of the outside world.
But it can't just build a model of the trees and the predators outside. It has to build a model of itself operating within that world.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It needs a centralized reference point to organize its actions, to allocate metabolic energy, and to maintain bodily integrity. The text argues that this centralized, incredibly complex, real-time dynamic predictive model is exactly what you experience as the self.
Hold on, I want to make sure I'm fully grasping the weight of this. The feeling I have every single day of being me, the internal narrator, the central character in the movie of my life, isn't a magical ghost placed in my head. But it also isn't a fake, useless illusion. You're saying it is a highly sophisticated, necessary, functional model constructed by my biology to pilot the ship.
That is precisely the argument. Think of it like the operating system on your laptop. Mm-hmm. Windows or Mac OS isn't a physical, tangible object you can pull out of the computer and hold in your hand.
Right. I can't touch Mac OS.
You can't put it on a scale.
Yeah.
But is it an illusion? No. It is a very real, mathematically rigorous, functional necessity for the computer to operate, manage its resources, and interface with the world.
Without the operating system, it's just hardware.
You just have a useless pile of silicon and metal. Without the brain's predictive model of the self, the biological organism couldn't coordinate its trillions of cells to hunt, socialize, or survive.
The self is the operating system.
Exactly. The self is constructed, yes. But it is constructed for a vital, real-world purpose. It is the biological tool that regulates action.
The set completely flips the script. It means the self isn't a lie. It's an evolutionary masterpiece.
It really is.
So if we've successfully rescued the concept of the self from the eliminativist void, let's see if we can rescue meaning. The text explicitly says meaning is enacted.
Yes, enacted.
And it uses this incredibly simple yet profound example. The author writes, quote, "The organism's needs, affordances, and interoceptive states create value, e.g., this food is good for me."
That is such a powerful sentence.
I think we need to really expand on this for the listener, because this is the exact moment where the dread really starts to evaporate. Let's do a thought experiment.
Okay, set it up.
Picture an apple floating in the dark vacuum of outer space, just an isolated apple. In a purely physical, objective universe devoid of any living creatures, that apple has no inherent value.
Yes.
It has no goodness or badness floating around it like an aura. It is just a collection of carbon, water, sugar, and trace minerals.
It is entirely chemically and morally neutral. Oh. It just exists.
Neutral, exactly. Now, let's change the scenario. Bring a biological organism into the picture. Let's say a human being who has been lost in the wilderness and hasn't eaten in 3 days.
A very desperate human.
Right. This human is currently experiencing a profound interoceptive state. Interoception is just the scientific term for the brain sensing the internal state of the body, right?
Yep, the internal bodily signals.
So the brain is receiving alarm signals, low blood sugar, an empty contracting stomach, dropping energy reserves. It senses a critical biological deficit. Now, the moment that starving biological organism encounters that physical apple,
everything changes.
Something magical but entirely physical and scientifically sound happens. Value is quite literally created in the universe. The apple suddenly is good.
Because it fulfills a biological need.
Yes. Not as some abstract philosophical poetry, but as a real, tangible, relational fact between the biological need of the organism and the physical properties of the object.
This is such a crucial point. If we connect this to the bigger picture of the text, this is exactly what the author means by enacted meaning. Meaning isn't something we just imagine.
It's not a fairy tale.
No, it isn't a hallucination we project onto a dead, indifferent world, the way you might project a movie onto a blank, uncaring wall. Meaning is dynamically generated through the physical vital interaction between a needy biological system and its environment.
The interaction is the key.
Yes. Your physical needs, your interoceptive states, act as the literal spark that ignites value in the physical world.
The spark that ignites value. I love that phrasing. Because without the hunger, without the biological stakes, the food isn't good.
It's just carbon and water again.
Right. The goodness is a real objective property that exists because you are a biological creature striving to stay alive. It is not a trick of the mind. The value is as real as gravity.
In understanding this, understanding that the brain actively predicts and maintains this bodily integrity, generating meaning and value along the way, leads us directly to the specific scientific mechanics the text uses.
The actual biology of how it works.
Exactly. It explains how this is actually achieved on a biological level. It's one thing to philosophize about meaning. It's another to see the mathematical engine driving it.
Which perfectly transitions us into the literal engine under the hood. The text doesn't just stop at philosophy. It states that brains evolve to predict, plan, and act to maintain homeostasis.
Homeostasis, yes.
Or, quote, minimize free energy in Friston's terms. And it states very clearly that this specific biological drive is what makes us genuinely agentic, not puppet-like.
We need to slow down and carefully unpack this reference to Carl Friston and the concept of minimizing free energy. I know it sounds like dense physics jargon.
It definitely sounds like dense physics jargon.
It does, but it's absolutely central to the paradigm shift the author is proposing. Carl Friston is currently one of the most cited and influential neuroscientists in the world, and his free energy principle is a grand unifying mathematical framework.
A framework for what, exactly?
For understanding how living systems resist the natural tendency of the universe to decay.
Are we talking about entropy here? The idea that the universe naturally wants everything to break down, cool off, and become chaotic?
Exactly. The second law of thermodynamics dictates that closed systems move toward maximum entropy, maximum disorder.
Like a messy room getting messier.
Or a sandcastle on the beach naturally eroding into a flat pile of sand. A hot cup of coffee naturally cooling down to room temperature. The universe tends toward chaos.
Right.
But life is the bizarre, stubborn exception. Life is a localized system that aggressively organizes itself, fights off entropy, and maintains a highly specific internal state. We call that state homeostasis.
Keeping the body temperature at exactly 98.6 degrees, keeping blood sugar perfectly balanced, keeping oxygen levels right.
Yes. If you fail to maintain homeostasis, your biological order collapses into entropy. You dissolve into the environment. You die.
Wow. Okay. High stakes.
Now, Friston argues that to maintain homeostasis and survive, biological systems must mathematically minimize free energy. In the context of neuroscience and predictive processing, free energy is essentially a measure of surprise or prediction error.
Okay, wait. You lost me there. Minimizing surprise. How does minimizing surprise keep me from dissolving into entropy? I mean, I like surprise parties.
Think about surprise, not in the emotional sense, but in the biological, statistical sense. Let's use an extreme example.
Okay.
If you are a deep sea fish, your biological model expects crushing water pressure, darkness, and cold temperatures. If you suddenly find yourself flopping around on a dry, sun-baked wooden dock, that is a massive biological surprise.
Oh, I see.
It is a catastrophic prediction error. Your sensory inputs are violently mismatching what your body requires to survive.
The environment does not match the internal model.
Exactly. That state represents a huge spike in free energy, a massive deviation from homeostasis. And it means death is imminent in a matter of minutes. Therefore, the fish's nervous system is evolutionarily designed to predict where water is and act aggressively to stay in it.
And by staying in the water, it minimizes that fatal surprise.
Precisely.
Oh, I get it. So surprise biologically means encountering a state that is incompatible with my survival.
Exactly. Now, scale that simple concept up through millions of years of evolution. The text frames human agency as a hard-won evolutionary achievement.
Hard-won.
We moved from simple organisms that just reflexively twitch away from a heat source to increasingly complex biological systems that can predict the future. We don't just react to the hot stove.
We plan around it.
We have an internal model of the world so sophisticated that we can simulate different scenarios in our minds. We can predict that winter is coming, realize we will be biologically surprised by freezing temperatures, and plan complex actions.
Like chopping wood and building a shelter.
Exactly. We secure resources months in advance, all to minimize that future free energy.
So let me ask you directly, trying to synthesize all this. Are you saying that the fact that my brain is constantly, exhaustingly trying to predict what's going to happen next so I don't die or starve or freeze?
Yes.
You're saying that that very predictive struggle, that fight against entropy, is the very thing that gives me free will?
Yes. That is exactly the profound shift the text is illuminating. The struggle is the agency.
The struggle is the agency.
The desperate biological need to maintain homeostasis in a dangerous, unpredictable, chaotic world forced evolution to build an architecture of agency. You are not a puppet being mindlessly pulled by strings of past causes.
Because puppets don't fight entropy.
Exactly. You are an intricate engine of prediction, constantly pulling yourself forward into the future to maintain your own existence. A puppet doesn't plan for winter. A puppet doesn't care if its strings are cut.
You do.
You deeply care. And the staggering biological machinery that allows you to care, to simulate the future, and to act on that care is what makes you a genuine, autonomous agent.
You are not a puppet. You are an engine of prediction pulling yourself forward. That is a powerful way to reframe the entire human experience. It completely flips the 2 a.m. dread on its head.
It really does.
But accepting this beautiful, scientifically grounded framework brings up a really confusing contradiction in my mind.
What's the contradiction?
Because if this embodied predictive model so elegantly explains our reality, if it mathematically and biologically grounds our agency and meaning, why on earth is neuroexistential anxiety still so incredibly common?
Oh, right.
Why do so many smart people and even highly educated neuroscientists still fall into the determinist trap and feel like puppets?
The author asks this exact question. So why does neuroexistentialism persist? And the answer provided is crucial to understanding not just the brain, but how the culture of science operates.
Okay, what's the author's answer?
The anxiety persists because, quote, many neuroscientists and philosophers still implicitly adopt a mechanistic, third-person, passive picture of the brain.
They're still stuck in the old view.
They are brilliant people, but they're still wearing the wrong philosophical glasses when they look at the data.
They are stuck in the third-person perspective. Let's unpack the difference between the third-person and the first-person view, because the text makes a big deal out of this.
It's the crux of the misunderstanding. The third-person perspective is the objective, outside observer view. It's the scientist standing in a lab looking at a functional MRI scan on a monitor.
Looking at the screen, not the person.
Right. They see the blood flow changing in the subject's brain. They see the neurons firing in sequence. They trace the chemical pathways. They're looking at the machine from the outside.
It's a series of mechanisms.
And from that purely external viewpoint, they logically conclude, look, it's just biology acting on physics. I don't see any free will molecule here, ergo no agency.
They are zooming in on the ones and zeros of the digital photo again. They are looking so closely at the code they claim the sunset doesn't exist.
Yes. It's the exact same reductive mistake codified into standard scientific practice. The text makes a vital philosophical correction here. It emphasizes that agency is an organism-relative property.
Organism-relative.
The source states beautifully, it's something you are, not something you see in a brain scan. You cannot find agency by looking at a system from the outside, because agency is the subjective experience of being the system from the inside.
Being the system that is desperately trying to maintain its own existence.
Exactly.
Let's relate this back to the listener's everyday life for a moment, to really ground it. Think about a time recently when you had to make a genuinely tough, agonizing life choice.
We all have those moments.
Right. Maybe you're deciding whether to quit a secure, well-paying job to pursue a passion project that might fail. Or maybe you were deciding whether to end a long-term relationship.
Heavy choices.
When you are in the thick of that decision, you are constantly running predictive models. You are weighing values, projecting multiple possible futures, feeling the biological weight of the risk and reward in your gut.
You feel it physically.
You really do. You are experiencing the undeniable first-person reality of agency. It feels heavy, it feels consequential, and it is real. To let a third-person brain scan invalidate that lived experience?
It's almost absurd.
It is. To have someone look at an fMRI and say, well, the scanner just shows dopamine receptor A interacting with electrical impulse B, so your agonizing sleepless nights were an illusion. That is exactly what the text means when it says we wrongly assume the first-person perspective is epiphenomenal.
Epiphenomenal, meaning it's just a byproduct.
Right. We assume our subjective experience is just useless exhaust coming out of the engine rather than the purpose of the engine itself.
That's a great analogy. It's like looking at a sports car engine from the outside and saying, well, I see metal pistons moving, I see spark plugs firing, I see gasoline combusting, but I've searched the whole engine block and I don't see a part called speed.
Right.
Therefore, speed must be an illusion. Speed isn't a you can point to. It's a property of the whole system in motion interacting with the road.
That's perfect. Agency is the speed.
Exactly. Agency is a property of the whole biological organism dynamically navigating its environment to survive. The anxiety persists because our scientific culture, for the last few hundred years, has heavily privileged the third-person, objective view, as the only valid way to discover truth.
But as the text powerfully argues, applying that strictly to conscious agents is a category error.
A massive category error.
Which perfectly brings us to the ultimate promise of this paper, shifting the paradigm from anxiety to curiosity. Because if we finally realize that the reductive third-person view isn't the only valid view of reality, we can break free from the trap.
And there are people leading the way out of this trap.
Yes. The text highlights a specific path out of the woods, mentioning the embodied predictive processing framework. And it specifically credits figures like Andy Clark, Anil Seth, and Jacob Howie.
These are the vanguard architects of this new understanding of the mind.
And their collective work over the last few decades represents a massive tectonic paradigm shift in cognitive science.
It really is a revolution in how we think about the brain. By adopting this embodied predictive processing framework, we finally move away from Descartes' passive, mechanical clockwork brain.
We leave the clockwork behind.
We embrace the active, constructing, surviving brain. The text summarizes the conclusion beautifully. The brain's ultimate job is to construct an agentic self, and that biological construction is incredibly real.
It is not a veil of illusion hiding the terrifying truth.
No, it is the truth of who we are.
I want to speak directly to you, the listener, for a second. Think about how deeply liberating this framework is. The text explicitly points out that this alternative perspective suggests that the neuroexistential anxiety is entirely optional.
It is a choice.
It is. It only arises if you falsely assume that reductive, eliminativist neuroscience gives the only or final description of human reality. But you don't have to choose anymore.
You don't have to tear yourself in two.
Right. Choosing between believing in rigorous, hard scientific facts on one hand, and believing in your own capacity to make meaningful, genuine choices on the other, they are not enemies. The science actually underpins and necessitates the choice.
It is a profound and beautiful synthesis of science and humanism. As the text concludes, discovering the neural mechanisms of behavior doesn't threaten who we are.
It does the exact opposite.
It explains how we came to be the meaning-making, choice-making agents we experience ourselves to be every single day. It shows us the intricate, billions of years in the making, evolutionary mechanics of our own freedom.
We aren't ghosts trapped inside a meaningless machine.
We are the machine itself.
Yeah.
And the machine is alive, predictive, purposeful, and constantly generating meaning. just by trying to survive.
We've covered an incredible amount of intellectual ground today. Let's do a quick overarching recap of the journey we've taken through this dense material.
Good idea.
We started in a place of dread, looking at the brain as a passive, meaningless chain of events, just dominoes falling from the Big Bang, making us feel like biological puppets.
The eliminativist trap.
Exactly. Then we banished the Cartesian ghost, realizing we don't need a magical, immaterial soul to have real agency. Instead, we transformed our view of the biological brain into an active, dynamic, predictive engine.
An engine that minimizes free energy.
Yes. We saw how this engine literally constructs a self as a tool to survive, and how our desperate physical needs actually enact and create tangible value and meaning in what would otherwise be a dead universe.
And crucially, we saw that this isn't just comforting philosophical poetry. It is grounded in the hard-won evolutionary reality of thermodynamics.
Fighting entropy.
The biological imperative to maintain homeostasis and mathematically minimize free energy to fight back against entropy and biological surprise is the very foundation of our free will.
The struggle is the agency.
The anxiety phase, exactly as the test promises. Because the reductive mistake of staring only at the ones and zeros has been corrected.
The anxiety fades. Curiosity takes its place. What a brilliant, optimistic closing thought from the author. But before we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over.
Something that builds strictly on the predictive homeostatic concepts we've unpacked today.
Exactly.
We spent this time establishing that our profound sense of self and our agency is a dynamic model constructed by the brain specifically to maintain physical homeostasis and biological survival in a dangerous physical world.
Right.
Our bodily needs, our interoceptive states like hunger, thirst, and temperature regulation are what enact meaning. But here's the question. What happens to our biological sense of agency as we inevitably spend more and more of our lives operating in purely digital virtual environments?
Oh, wow. That's a huge question.
When we are spending hours navigating avatars in spaces where our biological interoceptive states aren't directly engaged by the environment.
Where you can't actually starve or freeze.
Exactly. Where a mistake doesn't result in physical injury or death, but just a respawn screen. Does our biological architect of agency need to evolve an entirely new blueprint to find genuine meaning in a virtual world where physical homeostasis is no longer the primary immediate challenge?
That is definitely something to keep you awake at 2 a.m. But hopefully, armed with this new framework, it fills you with a sense of intense curiosity this time, rather than existential dread.
Curiosity is much better for your homeostasis anyway.
It really is. Thank you so much for taking this extensive deep dive with us today. It's been an incredible, mind-expanding journey unpacking this text, and we truly hope it has shifted your perspective on your own mind as much as it has ours. Keep questioning, keep exploring the mechanics of your own existence, and we will catch you next time.